Good evening. We have made it to Tuesday. One to go in this week of Vacation Bible School, and I know some of you have been here on a regular basis, and I appreciate that. And I hope that our lessons have been beneficial, and we've refreshed our minds about this old story. The story of Daniel, even though as the little kids continue to learn these stories time after time, and the story still remains the same. And yet there are some things that I've certainly learned in my preparation for class, and I hope I've been able to share some of that with you. We have learned on Sunday night about the faith of a young man and his willingness to have purpose in his heart to serve God and to do it in an appropriate fashion. Last night we had the story of three other men who had purpose in their heart, and even in the face of threatened death, they chose to stay with their commitment. And tonight we're going to have a rather unusual story that has taken place that the book of Daniel tells us about. Of course, Dane has already given us an introduction to this. It's all going to come from the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel. And there's going to be a little history lesson tonight in regard to some of our material about who these individuals are, where they might have come from, and how they ended up in power. And then we're going to see the story about the handwriting on the wall. Dana has already mentioned that he didn't know what language this was, and I told him that I don't know what language it is or was. The material that I read suggested, at least, that it was Aramaic. And we certainly know that Belshazzar, the king at that point in time, did not know what kind of language it was because he couldn't read it. So the period of time that we're actually going to be looking at, remember Dana mentioned his little introduction tonight about the amount of time. We first met Daniel in this book when he was about 15. The period of time that we're going to be talking about for today is going to be about 539 B.C., somewhere in that area. So virtually a 70-year period has gone by. So Daniel was somewhere 80 to 90 years old, and Dana and I were talking about this earlier on, that sometimes you kind of think about Daniel as just being that young man all the time throughout this book. But this book covers his entire lifestyle, or life phase, if you will, throughout the time that he was in captivity. And it covered about 80 years, or approximately that period of time. So we're going to be introduced to some individuals. The previous king that we've been dealing with was Nebuchadnezzar. And 23 years have now gone by since his death. And a lot of the story for tonight can apply, and we've heard it in our world, we've heard it in worlds past. If we don't learn from the lessons of history, we are doomed to repeat those lessons. And certainly many of us who have gone through a variety of stages in our world, here in the United States at least, have seen that take place. That seemingly we don't learn very well. And whether it's about the government in general, whether it's about society in general, maybe it's sometimes about us in general that we don't learn. The Old Testament in itself is written, and it's been described as our schoolmaster, our tutor, and by example, we can learn from the things in the Old Testament. The children of Israel didn't learn very well. Time after time after time, they made the same mistakes, if you will. And our lesson tonight is going to be an example of this to some degree, because as Belshazzar, when we were talking about, or Nebuchadnezzar, when we were talking about him, last night we talked about the fact that at some point in time he took pride and said, I was a god better than God Jehovah, better than all the gods. And as we got to the end of that particular book, because of the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he acknowledged that the God, their God was the chief God, if you will. Now, as we go down the line here, 23 years later, apparently the kings have forgotten about that. And as a result of that, they're going to repeat some of the same mistakes, if you will, that Nebuchadnezzar had done. And that first mistake that he got into, and this is going to be carried over into many other lessons in New Testament time, it's going to be carried over into our world today, that pride comes before the fall. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn that, and Belshazzar, the king for today, was going to have to learn that. I want you to bear with me just a little bit today as we go through some of this history. It's a little bit tedious, but I think it's important to kind of understand what's going on here. Again, the time frame, 539 B.C. When we first met Daniel, it was 605 B.C., so almost 70 years have gone by here. Nebuchadnezzar died back in 562 B.C., and when Nebuchadnezzar died, he was succeeded by his son. And Dana mentioned tonight that Belshazzar was an evil king, and he may well have been. But it's interesting, and I don't know the terminology and the origin of names, but Nebuchadnezzar's son, who succeeded him, his name actually was Evil Merodach. Now, if evil means the same thing there as it does in our world today, I'm guessing he wasn't a very good king. But perhaps in Babylonian world, that was not such a bad name. Or maybe, if you want to come up with a name for your son or your daughter, how about Evil Merodach? There it is. Now, he was on the throne for only a period of 2 years. And at that point in time, he was assassinated by an individual named Nergal-Lessar. And Nergal-Lessar actually was the brother-in-law of Evil Merodach. So he killed his own brother-in-law to succeed to the throne. I was hearing a message today about the time of the first century and some of the persecutions that Christians had gone through. And they mentioned Nero and his mistreatment of all the Christians during that period of time. And it gave a history of the things that Nero had done to all the people around. He killed many people, first of all, but to his own family. He had his mother killed, he had his sister killed, and he had numerous other people, aunts and uncles, killed within his own family. Reason being, because of the desire to be prideful, for the desire to be the king, desire to be in control and in charge. So here we have an example in biblical times in the book of Daniel about a brother-in-law who kills his own his brother-in-law just so that he can take over. Now, this particular guy served as king for a period of 4 years until his death of natural causes in 556 B.C. Now, in 556 B.C., we have some of the things that are going to be important to our study tonight. When that gentleman died, he had an infant son, and his infant son automatically became the next Babylonian king. Well, because of his lack of power, if you will, both because of life experience and other things of the young boy, there was a priest that had been appointed by Nebuchadnezzar some time ago, and that priest decided that he was going to take over here. His name was, it's not important to remember this, but it's Nabonidus, something like that. And he was a priest, but he led a revolt against this young boy, and he became the power in charge. Now, this priest decided that he didn't like to be the governor, didn't like to be the king, he didn't like all the power involved. In fact, he was kind of an individual who liked to study books, and he liked to pursue religious adventures, and because of all that, he abdicated his throne and he gave it to his son. And this priest went off into Middle Eastern land somewhere in what we call today Arabia or something like that, Saudi Arabia, and pursued scholarly ventures, reading of books, and became a religious recluse of some sort. So now we're brought to the fact that we have his son, and his name is Belshazzar, and he's the guy we're talking about tonight that's going to be significant in this story. So this is the line of succession all the way down. Belshazzar is the new king, and the period of time that we're now talking about is somewhere around 500 B.C. area. And we find out later in chapter 5 that he and Daniel are going to have a chance meeting, and that meeting is going to help Daniel become a much higher authority in the land of Babylon. Now to our story for tonight. Belshazzar, the king, has decided to have a feast in his palace for 1,000 of his noblemen and their wives and, it says, concubines, significant others, whatever it turns out to be. They're all brought into this palace. There's 1,000 of them there. And we're told early on in this story that there's a lot of wine flowing. And when Belshazzar tasted the wine, and I'm not sure it's because maybe 1,000 people there, or perhaps he did this deliberately, but remember back to Sunday's lesson when Nebuchadnezzar took siege of and captured Jerusalem and took all these people back into exile, he also took some things from the tabernacle or the temple. What did he take? He took some gold out of there. He also says he took some silver out of there. We're not told exactly what those were, but gold and silver utensils that were taken from the Jewish people from their temple. Well, Belshazzar now requests that somebody go to the back room, if you will, and to bring out all those gold and silver utensils or cups. Perhaps they ran out of cups. I'm not sure what the problem was, but he's going to use these to drink wine from. Now, I don't know how much of an offense that might have been and whether the Jewish people actually were aware of what was going on or not, but I will say that God knew it was an offense. It was God's material, if you will, his metal material in this case, that these people were using in an inappropriate fashion. So that's the background for what we're going to talk about today. Belshazzar and all these people are at this feast. The wine is flowing freely, and everybody seemed to be having a good time, if you will. And there's a statement in verse 2 of chapter 5 that we'll take a look at. It says, when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold, silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple. I've just gone through the succession line here, and obviously Nebuchadnezzar is not the father of Belshazzar. There's a couple explanations for this. Some people believe that the priest that I just referred to a moment ago, which was the father of Belshazzar, actually was the son-in-law. He was married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. Perhaps there's truth to that, which would make this individual a... Nebuchadnezzar was actually Belshazzar's uncle. The other side of it is, usually in Old Testament times, any mention of family members or people of older generations are sometimes described as their father. We talk about it in our world today also, our forefathers. Same principle here. But there was a relationship anyway that took place here. Now, the drinking of the wine continues. And in verse 4, we have the problem that develops here. As they are drinking the wine, they decide to give praise to somebody. Now, this is interesting to me. Instead of giving, I don't know that you want to give praise to God in heaven for the drinking of wine, but they chose to give honor to the God of gold, the God of silver, the God of bronze, the God of wood. Isn't there a place in the New Testament time in Romans that says that they worship the creation and not the creator? I think that's what these people were doing also. And remember, they've also tried to find, they're worshiping the sun god, the moon god. Now they're going to worship the gold god, the silver gold, whatever god, whatever it turns out to be. I got to thinking as I was going through this preparation for the class, I don't think things have changed a whole lot today. Now, we might not stand up and give praise to the god of gold, but I think sometimes there are individuals in our society that give praise, if you will, to the god of entertainment, to the god of sports, to the god of money, whatever it turns out to be. And I think that becomes their focus. And I think the message for us out of this lesson today might apply, that these individuals were giving glory where it didn't belong, and their priorities weren't set in the right place. And for whatever circumstance you find yourself in, you know, whatever you're, I'm using God in a small sense here, whatever your God of is, if it's not the God of heaven and His Word, then I think we have a problem. That was the case here. Now, as we get to verses 5 through 9 of this chapter, if you'll follow with me, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Now, Dana's already introduced for us that just out of the blue, if you will, if you're in the midst of whatever you're doing and suddenly a hand by itself appears, that would be scary enough, would it not? Let alone it starts writing. And the king observes the back part of this particular hand, and he is going to be... Put yourself in his shoes for a moment here. We're told that he is very scared about all this. In fact, let's get the description. Verse 6. The king's face grew pale. You know, all the blood kind of drained out of his face at this point in time. I want you to think just for a moment about a time that you found yourself fearful, because I think you're going to find yourself very similar to what the king was. First of all, his face was drained of blood. His thoughts alarmed him about what's going on here. His hip joints, according to this translation, went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Now, I've heard rumors before that the reason that these kind of podiums were originally put where people were speaking, public speaking, is because people's knees were literally shaking back here, and so they had to be covered. His hip joint went slack. His boots are going to fall down. I got to thinking about this. I had an event that happened one time with me. I walked into a place in a rather rural setting, and I was feeling pretty good at that point in time. I'm out in the country enjoying myself, having a good time. Walked into the area where I was, and slithering down the wall was, you know what it was. I wasn't prepared for that snake to be there. I will guarantee you that my knees were shaking. And for quite some time, my knees were shaking until I kind of got myself together. Similar response here that this gentleman has, this king has, because this is an unusual event, and he is fearful of the events that have taken place. His knees are shaking, knocking together. Now, the king calls together all his wise men, we're going to call them. It says that they are conjurers, says they are astrologers. There are all sorts of people that he calls together that they're advisors, if you will, to kind of help him through this particular situation, to get some explanation for what has taken place here. So he calls all these people together, and he asked, told them that if anybody could read the inscription and do an interpretation of the inscription, then they would be rewarded with having special clothes, purple clothing. They would also have a necklace of gold around their neck, and they would be placed number 3 ruler in the entire kingdom. That was to be the reward for these individuals if they could read, and not only read it, but to understand it, or to give interpretation of it. Well, surprise, surprise, all the king's wise men could not come up with the answer. They couldn't read it, and they could certainly not interpret it. And verse 9 tells us that King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So instead of being rewarded for their ability to give the answer to this, there's great perplexion, and the king is more scared than ever. Now, at this point in time, we're told that the queen comes into the feast. Now, there's some question about who this queen actually was. The queen perhaps was the queen mother, meaning the mother of Belshazzar. Perhaps it was his queen, I'm not sure, but isn't it interesting, at least it was to me, where was she while this drunken feast was going on? She wasn't in there drinking. And when somebody needed to have a clear head to give an answer to things, when the queen heard that the cries of the nobleman and the cries of the king had risen up about all this fearful stuff, the queen enters the picture. And the queen tells the king to settle down. Verse 10, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. And she begins to describe a man that is in his kingdom who has a spirit of the holy gods, as she described it. And in the days of your father, he had illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods that were found in him. You remember back to Sunday's lesson, for those of you who are here, the criteria for Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, number one, they had to be good-looking, they had to be intelligent, they had to be filled with wisdom about all sorts of different areas, and in this particular case, we're told that God gave special wisdom to the three guys. And to Daniel, he provided a measure of the ability to read dreams and to do interpretations. So the queen remembered this event that had taken place some time ago during Nebuchadnezzar's time, and she said, why don't you bring this Daniel in? So in verse 12, we're told that because of an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, this translation says. Anybody got another translation? What's that, Joe? Okay. Anybody know the definition of an enigma, by the way? It's an enigma right now within this group of people. An enigma is a puzzle. You just don't know the meaning of it, kind of a thing. Look at the definition of the things that are attributed here to Daniel. He had an extraordinary spirit. He had knowledge. He had insight. He had interpretation of dreams. He could explain enigmas or problems. And he solving of difficult problems were found in this particular individual. So let's bring Daniel in here and see if he can take care of this particular event. Now, there's some history out of the book of Daniel that we're going to need to remember in order for us to know the whole story here. Back in the second chapter of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. Nebuchadnezzar turned to his wise men of that day, and he invited them in to hear the dream and to provide interpretations. Not one of his wise men could come up with the interpretation. This was the dream about the gigantic statue. And it had a head of certain things all the way down to the feet of clay, I believe. And nobody could give the interpretation. Well, Daniel, remember he's been given a measure of interpreting dreams, was asked to come in. And he interpreted the dream for King Nebuchadnezzar. And he told him that the story was that there are going to be great kingdoms, including his own kingdom, and they were going to fall one at a time, all the way down to the last great kingdom that would last forever. Daniel was able to give that interpretation. As we get to chapter 4, which we didn't talk about the last couple of nights, Daniel again is called upon to interpret a dream. And again, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream that bothers him, and he calls in all the conjurers and all the astrologers and all the people to come up with this dream, and he cannot get the dream. They cannot get the dream. And as a result, we're told that Daniel came in and again gave the definition or the interpretation of this dream. So that material has already been in the kingdom. We already know about Daniel and his abilities. And for whatever reason, Belteshazzar did not know about him or had forgotten about him. So Daniel is now summoned into the area. Beginning in verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is the one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I have heard about you that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. And my wise men could not find an answer to this problem. But I personally heard about you that you were able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription, make the interpretation, then I'm going to put clothes of purple on you. I'm going to put a necklace of gold on you. And you're going to be the number three man in my entire government." There's a verse that follows with this, and I've said this to my class back in 109 several times, that even though we've read the story time after time after time, whatever it may be, that there's always verses that kind of pop out, if you will, to me and give me meaning that I hadn't really gotten. And the very next verse is one of those verses. Let's put yourself in the sandals of Daniel for a moment. He could have been a prideful individual and said, "I can interpret this dream. I'm the only one that can do this dream. Your wise people don't know anything. And I will take the prize, if you will." Let's look what he said, verse 17. Daniel answered and said before the king, "Keep your gifts for yourself or give them to somebody else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him, and I'm going to take all the glory and credit for this." Not what Daniel said. Daniel said, verse 18, "O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father, and because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. Whomever he wished, he spared alive. And whomever he wished, he elevated. And whomever he wished, he humbled." Now, before we go on with the rest of this, the verse that I had in mind was verse 17. The one that kind of jumped out at me is I'd read it how many times, but was Daniel there for the outward show and to make sure that he got the right clothes and he got the right gold and all that stuff? He was there to give glory to God. And I think the example, again, for us is an important one here. Daniel could have said, "Great, I'll take all the prizes you can give me." He said, "Keep the prizes, I don't want them. And if you have to, give them to somebody else." Now later on, we're going to find out that Daniel did accept some of these prizes, but his motivation was not to receive the glory. His motivation was to give glory to God. Now, verse 20, "And when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud," and we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar now, remember? He's just had this, he has total power over all those individuals around him. He can have people killed if he chooses. He can elevate people to positions of power if he chooses. "And because of all that, his heart was lifted up, his spirit became proud, that he behaved arrogantly. He was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him." God's responsible for this particular event. But Nebuchadnezzar started it all by his prideful attitude. He didn't give glory to where it belonged. And remember, Daniel's just said a couple of verses earlier in this, where did all this guy's power come from? God had provided it. And Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten that. Now, verse 21 is kind of an interesting verse. And Lynn mentioned this to me on the way in tonight about verse 21. He does not remember any place else in the Bible where some individual actually acted like a wild beast. Is that a fair statement? Okay, we're going to get that story in a moment. I got to think about it, Lynn. We did have a wild beast that acted like a human being. Right? Okay, we had a donkey that decided to talk and to do some things like that. But the end result of this individual's pride, and we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar's pride here, was that he became like a wild animal. And he was placed out in the field where he literally ate grass and lived with the animals. What a horrible ending to an individual that had been at this level of kingly power, if you will. And now he depends upon the grass of the fields for his livelihood. Verse 21, he was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beast, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Now, we're not told exactly when that happened, but apparently at some point in time, Nebuchadnezzar came to his senses, if you will, and recognized the plight that he was in. It's sort of like the story of the prodigal son we've talked about before. At some point in time, he came to his senses and decided, I can be better off over here at my father's house. In this particular case, apparently, Nebuchadnezzar reached the point of recognizing that God was responsible and that he gave credit to God, and I don't have to eat grass like the wild animals here. A horrible ending to this story. Now, Daniel's going to turn his attention now to Belshazzar, the king. And he's going to turn his attention to this particular story, the handwriting on the wall. That's a message that we still hear in our world today. The handwriting on the wall directly comes from this particular story. And the handwriting on the wall obviously is about, in athletic terms, I've heard people say, well, the handwriting was on the wall, so it's time to hang up the cleats, so to speak. The handwriting is on the wall for a particular governmental person, and instead of waiting to be fired or dethroned, whatever it turns out to be, they resign. The handwriting's on the wall. How well do we do sometimes at reading the handwriting on the wall? This king didn't do well at all, and Daniel's going to be there to help him to learn what the story's about. So he's going to turn his attention now to Belshazzar. And Daniel informs him in verse 22, and I'm fairly certain that the king was not expecting the message that's delivered here. Here's what Daniel said. Yet you, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. So somewhere along the line, Belshazzar knew about the history of Nebuchadnezzar, knew about him being out in the fields, and knew about the God in heaven, and he's forgotten all this. And as a result of that, you did not humble yourself. Daniel's going to get pretty direct here with the end results of this. But you have, instead of humbled yourself, you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. And here is the indictment against him. You've even brought the vessels. Remember those gold and silver vessels? You brought those vessels into the palace. And you and your nobles, your wives, your concubines have all been drinking wine from them. And you've praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. Again, there's coming a time, according to the scriptures, in which individuals had to be able to reach out and touch the gods, or a god, if you will. They didn't have the ability and the faith that was involved to know that a God in heaven cannot be seen, cannot be touched. But these individuals were looking to celebrate and worship the idol, worship the creation, not the creator. The story that Daniel is going to tell him, but he has the first clue given to him here, and your days are numbered here. Your kingdom is about to be ended, number one. Number two, Tekel. You have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. You weigh in the balance, and it should come out to an equal amount, but in this case, you've been weighed, you know, whatever the measure was, you didn't measure up. So number one, your kingdom's about to be taken away, and number two, you didn't add up to the weight that was needed here. And then finally, you farson or parries, depending on the translation that you read from, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Now, this was the message that Belshazzar was given. If I were given that particular message and somebody came in who had the abilities that Daniel had, I'm not sure I would have responded in a very favorable fashion, that my kingdom was about to be taken away, I was found wanting in the balance here, and that as a result of all this, my kingdom was going to be divided and given to somebody else. I don't think I'd have been real happy about that, but let's see what the result was. Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a necklace of gold around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as a third ruler of the kingdom. So for whatever reason, Belshazzar's got the message here. I suspect that had perhaps I had been in that circumstance, or perhaps somebody in this room, and we had the power of the king, we might have done this, as opposed to dressing the person in purple, putting a gold or necklace around his neck, and moving him to number three power in the kingdom. The number three power, as I understood it from the material that I read, for whatever importance this may be, we already had, remember, the priest who overthrew the little kid, and he decided to go search for whatever out in Arabia somewhere. He was the father of Belshazzar. Belshazzar should have been number one if you look at that as he succeeded here. But apparently the material that I read from at least said that the father was still co-king, if you will, with his son. So that was number one. Number two, number three in power in this case would have been Daniel. It's very reminiscent of the story of Joseph when he went down into the land of Egypt, and Joseph was appointed all the way up to number two in power of all Egypt. Daniel's now in charge of all this. Now, it says that the kingdom is going to be divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Now, the material that I read tonight, or for tonight's lesson, talked a little bit about the Babylonian Empire that was destroyed here. And it says that, according to the scriptures, on that very night, his kingdom was going to end. And the story is that's verse 30, by the way, if you haven't read that far. That same night, Belshazzar and the Chaldean king was slain, and so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. So how close was Daniel's prophecy and interpretation of this dream? It was right there. Now, according to history, the following happened to the Babylonian Empire. By the way, the Babylonians were a very powerful group of people. They had one of the seven wonders of the world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Babylon was a walled-in city that was very well protected, and the Babylonian kings, their culture, if you go back to the beginning of our lesson on Sunday night, their culture was to bring individuals in, such as Daniel, the intelligent individuals that they have captured, young, intelligent, wise, whatever it turns out to be, to bring them back to Babylon to indoctrinate them in their culture and in their learning and all those kind of things, and then to return them to the area so that they could enculturate the rest of the people. That was the plan of the Babylonian captivity. The Medo-Persian Empire was the one to succeed them. And by the way, if you go back to chapter 2 in this book, you'll see the interpretation, Daniel's interpretation of that dream exactly happen. The Babylonian Empire was to fall and the Medo-Persian Empire was to take over. According to the material that I read for the class tonight, the capturing of the city of Babylon was kind of interesting. It's a walled-in city. First of all, we've got 1,000 of their noblemen in the castle drinking and doing of that nature, so maybe some of their soldiers also, I don't know. But The story goes the following. There are two individuals involved here, and I spent some time, I asked Kay about this, and she knows about the history of ancient history. It's her one of her areas of expertise, because it says Darius took over here. According to some of the history books that we read, Cyrus was actually the king of Persia that conquered Babylon. My interpretation of this was, since it's the Medo-Persian Empire, that perhaps Darius was the king of the Medes and that Cyrus was the king of the Persians, and that's how that combination came about. But when Kay looked this up in history, Darius was an individual that came much later in history. And he is a king that we'll run into later on with the story of Esther. His name is Xerxes. And that was Darius the Great. So I don't know which person this was, but here is the capture of the city of Babylon. It's a walled-in city. In our world today, we're very familiar with this area because the Tigris-Euphrates River is the area that where many of our soldiers have been for quite some time. And it's said that either Cyrus or Darius, whomever this turned out to be, was able to change the flow of the Euphrates River, diverted it in another direction, built a dam, if you will, and was able to walk on dry land under the walls of Babylon and to take the city. The other speculation is that Cyrus or Darius, they were able to, you might think about this, if you're the guy that's in charge of the gates, and you see this horde of soldiers about to attack you, and you're offered your life to be spared, or perhaps you're given some money or whatever it turns out to be, if you just let open the door. The speculation was the second thing, that somebody was paid off in order for these the Medo-Persians to walk into the city of Babylon. But the kingdom ended this day, this great kingdom of Babylon, exactly as Daniel has predicted. So, the end result, you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting, so to speak. Your kingdom is going to be divided and given away. And exactly on that night, these things came to happen. So, that is the story for us today. And I guess if there's any practical things to learn from this, some of the things that I've already mentioned, I want us to, do we learn lessons from history? If you haven't, then we're doomed to repeat those particular events. Also, the events that Daniel has done here were done to honor God and to his glory, and weren't done to his glory. Some of the things that the king misused his power, which was another issue. He didn't learn from the history, from the lessons of the past. And he misused the temple utensils, if you will. And I got to thinking about that particular phrase. Today, what is the temple of God? Thank you. Could we not be accused of perhaps the same thing, misusing our bodies in some fashion, not to the glory of God. Also, to, as I said before, we might find ourselves worshiping at the feet of the god of money, the god of entertainment, the god of sports, the god of whatever. There's nothing wrong with those particular events. In fact, I like some of those events. And speaking of which, I appreciate Paul's announcement on Sunday about my baseball trip, your baseball trip. I had 12 tickets as of Sunday. I now have 3. So thank you very much. Still got 3 seats left, if you're interested. Now, the point is, there's nothing wrong with having entertainment. There's nothing wrong with having guests into your palace, if you will. There's nothing wrong with being entertained, but if you're doing it at the expense of other people and not doing it to the glory of God, and that's not your chief priority in life, then the possibility of misusing God's utensils, if you will, is there. So we are the temple of God. Let's take care of ourselves. Let's dedicate our lives to the service of God. And let's learn from the history, learn from the past here, the events that took place on this particular occasion. Comments, thoughts, questions about this story? If I can paraphrase what Lynn just said, we don't have to have Daniel or somebody to come interpret for us a dream or the writing on the wall. It's already written for us. The warnings are there. And the Babylonians didn't learn from their history, didn't learn from their warnings. And we have the same warnings today through God's word about what we need to do. As we see the day approaching, how are we to behave? That's a New Testament teaching. And we have the warnings and we have the responsibility to read God's word and to know how we're supposed to behave, if you will. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else today? Dana? God is still in control. Isn't it kind of interesting, it was to me, that God used the Babylonians to take his people into captivity as a form of punishment for the things they hadn't done. And the Babylonians didn't learn anything from that either. They turned right around and they forgot the power of God. So, yes. Okay, good point. Leon, you're right. The books are going to be open one of these days. And we are going to be weighed, if you will. Yes. And Leon's contention is that we've got to be on the side here and be found wanting. Not wanting. Being found by God. Yes. Thank you. Good point. Anybody else? Okay. Good stories. We know how Daniel handled things in this particular case, and the lesson that I want to deliver here is one: before the fall comes pride. Any of us can fit that category. We've got about 6 minutes till the kids come back, so take a break, stand up, stretch, go to the restroom, get something to drink, whatever, and be back in your seats by 9:45, about 6 minutes. Thank you for being here. Thanks for your listening. And your